This narrator advises that the listener digest the following as entertainment. The showrunners behind it are neither six-figure filmmakers nor professional critics. They are casually critical.
Welcome to Casually Critical, the podcast show starring two pals who love to talk about storytelling. I'm your host, Daniel Carpenter.
And I'm your co-host, James Newton. Guess who's coming to dinner? It's me, it's Daniel, and it's you. And about halfway through dinner, we're going to be discussing some spoilers for the film, aforementioned, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which came out in 1967. So whenever we get to that point in the discussion where spoilers are being discussed, I highly recommend that you jet on out before the salad is done and get some air and then go watch this movie because it's very cheap to rent on Amazon Prime.
You know what they say about dessert. If you have dessert before dinner, you'll spoil your dinner. So don't spoil your dinner and stick around for spoilers if you don't want that.
There you
go. Your dinner.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Full circle. So, James, we both chose this movie because this was really in a lot of ways, this is a very different antithesis to Gone with the Wind, which we reviewed a few episodes back. Gone with the Wind, for those of you that didn't listen to our episode, was not received well amongst the casually critical reviewers that are also your hosts.
He's speaking in the third person now.
Daniel and James did not like it very much, but we're here now with Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which came out almost exactly 30 years after the fact, and it came out the exact same year that my dad was born. Shout out, bio father.
Wow, congrats.
Yeah, well, it's a little late to congratulate him, but yes,
he was born. Congrats on your dad being born. That's all I was
trying
to say.
Yeah. Thank you. It means a lot. So, James, I remember I saw this movie. I was introduced to this through one of my classes in college. A professor had introduced me to it. James, is this your first time seeing this movie?
No, this was actually on our hit list of movies to watch before I went to college. So, alongside Shawshank Redemption and Casablanca, along came Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. My parents said, you've got to see this before you go to school. There's a bunch of classics that we've been meaning to show you, and this is one of them. And so,
Worth the wait?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm really glad that I watched it then, and I'm really glad that I watched it this time. It's an enjoyable experience, and it plays out a lot like other good films that are adapted from plays, like 12 Angry Men. And for the most part, those adaptation elements do work quite well, because the movie is strongly carried by its actors, including world-renowned Spencer Tracy, Sidney Poitier, and Katharine Hepburn. Those are the most of note actors. I don't recognize any of the others from any other films, but Katharine Hepburn obviously is kind of aging out. She still did a lot of acting after this film, but she is beyond her prime in this film, and I would say she does well. Spencer Tracy, I know only by name, but apparently he's in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. I think that's how many mads go in it.
Bless you.
And then Sidney Poitier, you may have recently heard the name, Daniel, and listener, because he passed away last year. Or maybe it was this year, actually. Sure. But I know him also from In the Heat of the Night, and he is a really, really excellent actor. And I forgot about that until we decided to watch this movie and I checked it out. But Daniel, can you tell us a little more about the plot of this film?
I certainly can. So it features Sidney Poitier as the leading role, kind of co-sharing it with Katharine Hepburn. And he plays, basically it's about a couple. They just met in Hawaii. And over the course of about 10 to 14 days, they've gotten to know each other. They fell in love, and now they want to get married. So Katharine Hepburn plays one of the lovers. She is very much into Sidney Poitier's character, and he goes with her back to her parents to ask for their blessing as long as there are no objections. So this is a very odd and very interesting situation, but really the creme de la creme on top of it all is Katharine Hepburn herself and her parents are white, and Sidney Poitier, this man that she is going to be married to or wants to, is black. And even though at first there seems to be no objections, why would there be any? She was raised to believe that, yes, even though black people are different skin color, that's really all that separates us from them. And yet her parents, especially her father, played by Spencer Tracy, discover that there might be some hidden conflict and tension underneath themselves that they've never really had to be forced to deal with before. And as the ridiculous antics of this this dinner that they're about to have kind of escalate naturally. Well, I wouldn't say naturally. Nothing about this is natural. But as things begin to escalate, so too do the tensions, and a lot of truth gets spit out. So this reminds me a lot of The Breakfast Club, shining a light on something that not a lot of light is shown upon, highlighting at the time, which was a very politically heavy topic, which is interracial marriage. And at the time that this movie came out, it was outlawed in, I think, 14 of the 50 United States. Although I believe 2 days after this movie came out, that number changed as the Supreme Court ruled that banning interracial marriage was in fact unconstitutional. It also does bear mentioning, and it's a little behind the scenes thing, that Spencer Tracy was considered a giant of an actor for his day, not physically, but in terms of his talent as an actor. And at the time of recording, or not the time recording, at the time they made this movie, he was actually gravely ill. And as a matter of fact, tragically, 17 days after they finished filming, he died.
Shoot.
So he was gravely ill. They structured all their film days around his illness. So when he felt like it, because some days he just couldn't film, he would film from 9 a.m. till afternoon. And then that was it. They had another draft of the movie where his character wasn't featured in it hardly at all, just in case he ended up dying before they were able to finish production, which fortunately he was able to tough it out, and this ended up being his final role. He didn't win an Oscar, but he was nominated posthumously for his role in this. So all that being said, there was a lot of work and a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. I think there's a lot more to unpack there, obviously. But James, if we look at this from a, well, I was about to repeat myself and yourself, 10,000-foot view. Let me reword that.
It's usually from a different footage. I feel like we never say the same thing. Sometimes it's 5,000, sometimes it's 3,000.
That's true.
I'll take whatever, though.
James, if we look at this from a 999.9-foot view,
okay,
a little bit closer than a 1,000-square-foot view,
mm-hmm.
When we try and, because you and I have the advantage of, and disadvantage, we're not in the 60s anymore. You and I are growing up as young men in the 20s, the 2020s. And so looking at it from that lens as a film, as perhaps political commentary, does this movie succeed at what it tries to do? Is this a good movie?
That's a good question, Daniel, because I think one of my biggest questions that I wanted to ask you was, what is this film trying to do? Because I really don't know. I think this film turns out to be a lot more tepid than I thought initially, which I don't fault it for. It's still a very well-made movie, but it does come off as pretty inoffensive in a lot of areas at the end of the day, which is, I think, where part of my disappointment with the film lies. Most of it, actually. The rest of it is very superficial stuff. So, I don't know. I don't know if we want to talk about this in the non-spoiler section, about what we think this movie is about, or what do you think the movie's trying to say?
So I'm going to not directly answer your question, James, because I really feel that's something we can hash out in our spoiler section. Great. That being said, what I want to do is indulge my fire and brimstone critic side and completely roast Gone with the Wind and put it deeper into its grave, where I can finally ignore it for all time. Because I want to point out the things that this film does really well compared to Gone with the Wind.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, the African-Americans, the black people in this movie, they're actual characters, and you'll love to see it.
Wow, unbelievable. A person playing person?
No way, you know? You'll love to see it. You'll love to see the fact that these are more than just low, stupid, noble beasts that pick cotton in fields. No, these are actual people that have dreams, aspirations, limitations, and flaws. That's something that our modern movies can't even seem to get right.
Wild how much film can change in 30 years, Daniel.
Yeah, considerably so.
Yeah,
and
the world as a whole, I guess.
Absolutely. And in some ways, there is one character played by Isabel Sanford Tilly, who is the black housemaid of this white family. And we saw this exact same thing in Gone with the Wind with Mammy. However, I just can't help but just see Tilly as just that full circle of, you know, she has that sass, but she also is a character. She has her own disagreements. She has her own objections. I wish she had a bigger part to play later on without spoiling anything, but she isn't portrayed as dumb. She isn't portrayed as well-intentioned, but stupid. There's at least a little bit more in the way of nuance and irony in some cases, which is interesting concerning her character. I will say, in terms of filmmaking alone, in terms of technical stuff, this film is incredible.
Yeah.
The camera work is amazing. I remember not too long ago when I was a young buckaroo beginning to make my way downtown, into film college, one shots were all the rage, meaning one long interrupted take. This film shows, move aside Nolan, move aside every cinematographer worth his salt. We were doing this all the way back in the 1960s. No, they're not super grandiose or as super long because there wasn't as much visual effects to hide behind, but there are a lot of long shots in this movie. A lot of curving around of the camera, arcing the camera around a scene to get another perspective. There is a shot involving a mirror and a couple looking into that mirror. We briefly cut away. We pivot away from the mirror just to focus on a really meaningful close-up shot. It's those moments, James, where go,
it's so good, mwah. Daniel.
For those of you who aren't seeing what we're doing now, I am making out with the movie.
He's actually doing there's a little so chef's much. Kiss. I don't want your mental, your imagination to be shattered by this image of Daniel making out with a DVD hard case of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. There's another shot I wanted to highlight in which Spencer Tracy's character goes to cancel his golf plans with Monsignor Ryan after his first encounter with his daughter and her fiance. And the camera moves all the way around the table and then frames him with Sidney Poitier's body kind of blocking out an entire third of the shot. And then right next to him, only much farther back in the scene, is a very small Spencer Tracy ducking into the glass door leading into the house. I can't better explain that. You just need to go see the movie because there's just some really cool shots. Another one being, including Tilly actually, where the camera just goes crooked. And that's the only time it does. And my mind, I was just, I don't know, there was something primal in me that just like, I was very afraid. And it did exactly what it was supposed to do. The camera shift filled me with fear.
It unsettled you.
Yes, I was like, this doesn't feel right because this camera isn't supposed to do this.
It reminds me of that one moment in Knives Out. You know the moment where it goes into handheld mode very obviously and very abruptly, but very purposefully as well. There's one shot towards the end of the movie where Spencer Tracy's character is walking around outside of his house. And we see in the background, and they're slightly out of focus, we see all these different people. We see Sidney Poitier alone in the study. We see all these people. And it's a great visual for the moment, for the narrative drama, as his character is kind of wrestling around with a few things. Really, really well done. I will also say, besides the excellence in cinematography, there is an excellence in music, specifically the lack of music.
Mm-hmm.
There are many moments where the music doesn't do anything. And let me explain a bit why that's significant. A lot of times in a movie, music can be used for shorthand for emotion. Like, oh, it's a sentimental moment, so let's break out the acoustic guitar and have some strumming going on.
Once again, are we playing lawful, neutral, or chaotic Dixie in the background while watching a scene from Gone with the Wind? Because all of the above.
And in this case, they choose the best Dixie there is, which is none.
No Dixie at all. Love
which, in my opinion, is the best Dixie.
Amen.
And I believe that was also your Dixie alignment, if I'm not mistaken, back in our Gone with the Wind review.
Yes. No Dixie. That is my Dixie alignment.
But Dixie alignments aside, whatever Dixie you prefer, music can easily manipulate you and say, oh, I'm supposed to feel uneasy about this scene. Oh, I'm supposed to feel whimsical and aloof. Oh, I'm supposed to feel sad in the scene. Nope. They're like, nope, you won't know how to feel in the scene, just like a lot of these characters don't know how to feel. We're just going to leave you alone in the silence. And it's that and the cinematography and a lot of other things that makes parts of this film, especially in the beginning, feel strangely Hitchcockian in a way.
I know exactly what you mean.
There was a deliberateness in the tension and the lack of music, pulling away, saying, yeah, you're going to fend for yourself. We're not giving you any hints as to what you're supposed to feel.
The lingering, uncomfortable shots of a person's facial expression just shifting to this taste. It's just like, oh, man, I don't want to be in this shot anymore. Can we leave? And the director's like, no, we're going to hang out here for like 10 more seconds, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, it's brilliant. There's a deliberateness to this movie. This movie was nominated for a ton of Oscars. One of them it won, which was Best Adapted / Original Story and Screenplay. And the poignancy and the emotions, especially at the end, remind me a lot of The Breakfast Club. It's both exactly that way and nothing like that. This calls attention, whereas Gone with the Wind kind of ignored the blatant racism and in some ways celebrated it and said, hey, look at the noble South. They're so nice to their slaves, the lowly, lowly blacks. In this one, it's like, no, yeah, blacks and whites are, the differences are very much felt. And some people don't see the difference. And there's kind of cons to that. And some feel the difference very, very much. And there's some pros and cons in terms of that. And so there's this awkwardness, this emotional tension of how do we feel about this? I don't know, but let's explore that a little bit.
And to clarify, there are some timely implications that come with an interracial couple in the late 60s. It's very different. Like you said earlier, it was illegal in a lot of states. And one character mentions the potential of a mixed race child. What they might face in the early 70s, growing up wherever they grow up in the United States. There's a lot of danger that's there, and a parent may be concerned about that for their future grandchild. So it's not entirely just out of a visceral, suppressed racial reaction. It's also like, there's some social ramifications to this, which are valid, but how valid are they at the end of the day?
Very true. Very true. To echo James's question, as we concluded our non-spoiler segment in Gone with the Wind, and as we begin to wrap up that same segment here, I want to ask and then answer that same question, which was, would you recommend this to anybody? I would say, Gone with the Wind, the only value I saw in it was the discussions that might be had so long as you had them.
Yeah.
It's not as I likened it to a pufferfish. There's toxins in this movie. You need to remove those toxins and carefully prepare it in your mind and then discuss it. That's why it's important. This movie is like pufferfish flavored sushi. The toxins are long gone. It has already been carefully prepared and creatively combined with a lot of other surprising elements and recipes, and it's far more palatable for people. There are some things worth discussing, which I have no doubt that James and I will sink our teeth into more in the spoiler review, but this is an overall superior equivalent to Gone with the Wind. I don't think it's even that equivalent. It's half the length, more than double the quality, more than triple the quality in its technical execution, in its acting, and overall in the texture and variety it brings to an otherwise very difficult to digest and really think about topic.
So, and just about every character changes as well, which is not something you can say about Gone with the Wind, where the only thing that really changes is the South, which it laments.
Yes,
but
regrettably.
Let's go ahead and move on to the second course of our dinner, Daniel, into the spoiler part of our talk.
But hold on. First, while we pick our teeth away, what would you rate this movie?
Ooh, as I'm licking my fingers, I'm going to give Guess Who's Coming to Dinner a 4 out of 5.
I'm close. I'm going to say a 4.5 out of 5. I think this movie has some really solid strides. But towards the end, though it somewhat fumbles, I don't ever feel it overall compromises its momentum.
Yes, and I have a few gripes that will not let me go all the way to a 4.5 or a 5, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But all in all, okay, I will recommend this movie to anybody. Go check it out. It's really easy to watch. Yeah. I want to hear your thoughts, honestly, because I'm sure Daniel and I are going to have an interesting conversation here.
Well, that's it for Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Guess Who's Coming to Spoilers? I don't know, but we'll see you there.
Want to join the conversation? Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Casually Critical Podcast. Get the inside scoop on future episodes. Feel free to message us on either platform to join in the casual correspondence or provide feedback on the show. Now it's time to dive into our spoiler review.
All right. We're here, folks. And we haven't been saying this a lot in our recent episodes, but please, if you haven't seen this movie, I would urge you to stop listening. This is one of those movies that you definitely don't want to learn a lot about. Obviously, you can enjoy it if you've already seen it before, but what's the point, right? Don't spoil. Don't open your Christmas presents before Christmas. Santa's not even here yet. So, James, I gotta ask you. There's one scene that really, really bothers me in this movie, and it's a scene between the characters of Dorothy and Delivery Boy, played by Barbara Randolph and Skip Martin. They just kind of, he shows up, he boogies down, she boogies down, they boogie down, they leave, that's it. What the heck's up with that?
Daniel, I'm going to get on my little literary soapbox for a second here.
Ooh, okay, let me get off then. Let's give you a wide berth.
After Romeo and Juliet commit suicide together at near the end of the third act of the play, there is a seemingly unrelated scene where all of the footmen and housemaids are arguing amongst themselves about the banquet and about petty business and squabbling, and it's supposed to be a sort of a bit of comedy to levy out the tension and make it feel a little bit lighter. I feel like that's what was trying to be accomplished by this little escapade with the Delivery Boy and Dorothy. Both characters serve no purpose to the plot at all. They just zoom off in their car. They dance to some sitar music, which apparently the sitar was a big instrument in the late 60s, which is so unfortunate. But what do you think, Daniel? Do you think it accomplishes this sort of bit of levity after a lot of tense interactions early on in the film?
I'm all for levity. Even Alfred Hitchcock would string along his suspense, but even the great filmmakers know not to do one emotion for too long because it can get too heavy. Some movies are too heavy, and I guess rightfully so, but those are never movies I would want to rewatch. But some other movies like Knives Out, like Jojo Rabbit, do a great job at balancing that. But with this movie, this scene in particular does one thing that I really don't like, and that is it's a scene about biracial marriage, and we are honed in excruciatingly on Sidney Poitier's character and Katharine Hepburn's character. It's their relationship, and they're up kind of against the world, and their parents are concerned about that. They feel the weight of that, saying, hey, if you decide to be together, you're going to have a lot of crap thrown at you. And this was before all the civil rights stuff. This was before, or Martin Luther King was still alive when this movie came out, but this was before we made a lot of advances in our society that we have today, that we get to enjoy today. And by randomly moving on to another, people that, I'm not going to say they're a thing, but the way that Dorothy and the delivery boy interacted seemed very, very friendly. And I was just thinking, okay, we're honed in on this one possible biracial couple to be. And then we're cutting away to Joe Schmo and Sally McGalley, who are two differently raced people just hanging out. And I thought, oh, so it's a normal thing then. Like, that's how it came across. Like, oh, look, right outside their own door, there's another biracial couple to be. It just, it felt like it was suddenly removing the focus from just the house and moving on to just, oh, well, this is a thing now. You know, either you're on board or you're off board.
Yeah.
And I think that for me did more harm to the story than it did good.
I agree. And I think there are a lot of instances in which levity was provided. There's a lot of little bits of visual comedy that I really enjoy in this movie. And I didn't appreciate the first time watching it. I like it a lot the second time because I had a lot more brain space to pay attention to the things like the camera angles and the secondary action, you know, in the film, in the scenes, I mean.
Yeah.
One of which you already talked about, the mirror scene, where the father winds up putting his shaving brush in a glass of gin on accident. Several other scenes with him as he kind of unravels in frustration, getting ready for this dinner, trying to put socks on. The socks don't fit. He tries to open the drawer. The drawer flies out. All the socks come tumbling out while he's talking to Monsignor Ryan.
He's also kind of the comic relief, Monsignor Ryan. He's not overtly funny, but he's more lighter hearted.
Right. He's the best. But then there's an instance where Spencer Tracy opens the closet. He's trying to get a tie. All the ties fall off of the tie rack in the background. He tries to put the drawer back in with all the socks, tries twice, it doesn't fit, so he just gives up and drops it on the floor. All this stuff is going on while there's very serious conversation going on between himself and Monsignor Ryan, who seems to be really the most level-headed, the least impulsive of all of them. I would say Monsignor Ryan is really the voice of the director, the voice of the writer in this movie.
Yeah.
He seems to be the most like, what's the big deal? Come on. Like, if they're in love, then they're in love, which seems to be, as we were discussing earlier, what is the message of this film? I think the message is exactly that. The situation, the circumstance doesn't matter. What matters is that these two people are in love and their feelings forego all concern, all reason, all caution. I don't know. That's what I gathered from it. And if that's really all this movie has to say, then at the end of the day, I'm a bit disappointed. But maybe you got something more from it than me.
What I really liked was, I keep coming back to this word, but texture. That's there. Because if this movie was done in 2020, number one, Spencer Tracy's character would be incredibly underdone. He would be more bigoted for sure. And, but for example, the character of Mr. Prentice, John Prentice's father, he also is totally for the idea of like, no, blacks marry blacks, whites marry whites. We don't cross those lines. It's how he was raised. That's hardly ever addressed in modern media nowadays. They were used to life that way. But the point was, it's not as simple as all blacks were okay with this just universally. Some were okay with it. Some had reservations. Some were against it. And this really helps bring that multifaceted nature to the table. And they even try this with Spencer Tracy's character at the end, where everyone's coming down on him saying, dude, what the heck is holding you back? And they hit some notes really well with him. They get a lot of him right. But his ending speech, while powerful, ends on some notes that don't sit quite as well for me. It's like putting your phone flat on the table, except the camera bump makes it not quite as flat, so it's a little shaky, but the way you put it down was really loud, you know? where it's defiant. You're like, dang, okay. But then you think about it more and you go, wait, what? For example, his closing dialogue statement is, you have said this about me. You have said this about me. You have said this about me. You finally said this, which actually is the only one that actually makes a solid point. And he unpacks that. And he says, no, I'm not closed-minded. I am, but I love my wife. And ultimately, if you feel this way, I can't stop you. And, or he doesn't say that. That would have made more sense. He says, if you feel this way, then that's good. And if it's half as much as I felt about my wife, and I'm like, wait, felt? I don't, like when they were getting ice cream, he was checking that girl out that was giving them the ice cream. I'm like, I see where your eyes are going there, Mr. Drayton. I don't know, man. It there seems to be an undercurrent of tragedy to that speech. The tragedy of like, yeah, feeling love is great, but that feeling isn't always there. It's about the choices you make to continue to love that person. It's about the commitment. And
I really didn't see anything about their marriage being on the rocks, except whenever this compromising situation happened. I think he was mostly just referring to sexual vitality and how that you know, ebbs and flows throughout a person's life. And as a person gets older, that goes away.
Yeah, I'm not saying their marriage was on the rocks, but there were certainly things that, I don't know, it's hard for me to say, are they the prototypical old American couple? Or are there certain quirks that were deliberately put in there to call out specific people from this movie? I don't know. That's the one disadvantage I have for not being in the culture when this movie was dropped in like a hot potato. But yeah, he was definitely checking out the ice cream girl. They even make a point of having his wife notice and then clear her throat. And then he kind of, you know, withdraws. So there's definitely, while they're not unhappy, they're not 100% happy. And this kind of, I think, emphasizes flaws that were already there that kind of come to the forefront in a dramatic way, because the situation they're going through is certainly dramatic. But James, I'm curious to know, I feel like you were talking around it in our non-spoilers, the ending speech, which I feel kind of ties the writer using it to tie all these thematic elements together. Did they do that well?
I don't think so. I think they just recapped the movie, which I didn't really need a recap because it's only an hour and 48 minutes long. And frankly, I just think that there's a lot more that could have been revealed about Spencer Tracy's character if he hadn't just recalled the things that had happened before. Because like you said before, he said, here are five things that were said about me. Here's one thing that I will disagree with. All the other ones, we're not even going to talk about those things. We're not going to talk about any of the other events. We're just going to give you a quick recap of what happened today. It's like at the end of a Saturday morning cartoon where it's like, all right, everybody gather around. What lesson did we learn from this part of the story? And
I disagree. I know the type of generation that Spencer Tracy was playing, Matt Drayton, his character. My grandfather talks like that. My great uncle talks like that. These long speeches of, this person said to me this, and at first I took offense, but the more I thought about it, like, that long-windedness is definitely a characteristic of that generation.
To me, that just didn't feel like a person talking. I don't know. It didn't feel... There were a couple moments in this movie where people were talking and waxing poetic in ways that I was like, this does kind of take away from the groundedness of it.
That's fair. That I will give you that. There are some times where I felt they were a little on the nose.
Yeah.
One thing I wish was done differently was Katharine Hepburn, the more...
I want to correct something, Daniel. Katharine Hewton is the one that plays Joey, the young woman. Katharine Hepburn plays her mother, Christina.
Dang. Okay. The IMDb photos are very misleading.
Yeah. I believe Katharine Hewton is related to Katharine Hepburn, and also both of their names are Katharine. So
she's a niece, or Katharine Hewton is the niece of Katharine Hepburn.
Okay.
But thank you for correcting me there. Katharine Hewton, and unfortunately, I don't know if I can retroactively correct every single instance I brought it up. Katharine Hewton, who plays Joey. Thank you, James, for saving part of the podcast. So the character of Joey, she's portrayed as this unashamed progressive woman, basically saying, "No, I don't see anything wrong with that. Like, that he's just a person." And even John Prentice calls attention to this by saying, "I don't think she sees me as a colored man." He says, "I don't see myself as a colored man. I see myself as a man." And I feel like that's the way she sees him. However, what I liked at first was they seem to have a two-pronged approach. Number one, this is a good thing because unlike her parents, she isn't really holding herself back from loving this man. But number two, there is a naivety to it. She doesn't seem to fully understand what she's signing up for, and that's something her father, mother, and even John and his family seem to know as well. I wish there had been more of a calling out moment. Now, to give the writers a benefit of the doubt, I feel like this long-winded dialogue speech, I feel what they're trying to do was pull from the mystery genre, where the detective brings everyone together and has a long-winded speech recounting the events and then recontextualizing them in a cohesive way that brings it all together. And you're like, oh, okay, wow. And I feel they almost did that, but they didn't. And they didn't really know. They had an exclamation point. They had an exclamation mark. They just didn't have the point of the exclamation mark. They didn't have the one thing to drive it all home, to fully wrap everything up. And I don't think there was a lot of thought put into what each person was saying about him grievance-wise. I don't think he did a satisfactory enough wrapping that up. With the over-idealishness of Joey, he tells her, "Joey, for once in your life, for the one time I have to tell you the thing, for you to listen to things I have to tell you to do, shut up." And I was like, okay, shoot. So he's about to lay down some facts, but he doesn't. His wife does a better job when she dismisses Hillary, her friend that was running the place.
That was a really great scene.
So all that being said, it was a powerful moment, but there was no one summit of that peak that it capstoned on. There was no moment where I went, oh, that's what it was about. Mm-hmm. I went, man, he really redeemed himself. And then I'm like, wait, did he? The whole point was they were all wrong about him, or at least most of them were. So I was left confused.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think this movie is the strongest in its first and second act, where it's just setting up these amazing large dominoes that are just looming over you, about to fall. Like, first it's like, look, it's an interracial marriage coming your way. And then it crashes into another domino that says, and they're leaving soon. And now their parents are coming for dinner. And they're just all coming towards you. You're like, well, how are we going to solve this problem? And then, It's not, like you said, it's not solved as deftly as I would prefer. I don't have the answers for how that would be solved better, because I'm very fresh off of watching this movie and haven't had a whole lot of time to think about it. But even if I did have time, I don't think I would know how to solve this. But the third act does stumble a little bit. I think that is why it merits a little bit lower rating than a 5 for me. If you don't mind, if I kind of pivot a little bit and talk.
Let's pivot.
Okay. So you were talking about how Sidney Poitier's character says, "I don't see myself as a black man. I see myself as a man, unlike you, Dad." Yeah. I want to know how in anti-colorblind culture, how this film holds up in the eyes of the far left. Because this is a culture that we live in which... and I'm going to step on some toes here. This is a culture in which not being able to acknowledge distinguishments between people is wrong, even if those things are completely superficial. Now, I know that there are cultural implications sometimes to those superficial things, and I don't know much of anything about those cultures. But whenever someone says, "I don't see color," that's now an incorrect thing to say, which I do see the point of. But I want to know if this film, in its messaging, would still be something that would be revered by, I don't know, like an example would be like the NAACP. Would they still uphold this movie? Would BLM uphold this movie and say, this is a great example of racial reconciliation and those things? Or because of its colorblindness, its colorblind attitudes, which are old-fashioned now, would it crumble?
You're absolutely right. I'm actually glad you pivoted in this direction, because I was going to pivot in this direction as well, specifically about John Prentice, but I'll get to him in a moment. I did some armchair research.
Ooh.
Because I'm always scared to say research, because I'm afraid people are like, well, did you read this? Like, no, it's armchair research, guys. It's casually critical. We're just talking about the movies. We're not defining the movie. There was some controversy that came out because of this film after the fact, a few decades in. Even just 20 years later, in 86, there were a few things that caused people to label this film as dated, specifically with the character of John Prentice. John Prentice is a character who has the perfect resume. He is, and I believe the director was quoted as saying, he is ideally perfect. He's flawed, sure. He's human. But the reason they positioned him that way was actually deliberate. It was so that the only objections the parents would have, aside from the rushed 10-day dating into marriage thing, the only objections would be on race.
Yeah.
And that has ruffled a few feathers. And a lot of people have said, well, that's, you know, I mean, not every black person's going to have that resume. And I think they're absolutely right. However, to your point, James, the ugly reality of racism, not just America, racism in general, it's something the human race has wrestled with. And in America, we first solve that by saying, okay, I see that the black community, the black culture is hurt. So maybe the best thing we can do is say, well, let's not treat race as a thing, because the last time we did it, it hurt people. Let's focus on, I might be white, you might be darker skinned, you might be black, but you know, we're going to put that both aside. And that seemed to work well for some people. And now we're in a place where we're the exact opposite way. We're saying blackness is something that shouldn't just be acknowledged, but celebrated. We need to celebrate black culture. We need to celebrate the black community. We need to celebrate Black Panther, a movie that was created almost entirely by black people, except for Kevin Feige, who is white. Even this movie, I struggled to find a single black person behind the scenes. In fact, I have yet to find one. The director, The storytellers, the cinematographers. We value representation. I struggle with that as well. I know we talked about that with Kubo. We talked about that recently on some of our episodes. James, I struggle with that.
We're still figuring this out, man. We're still figuring all this out. So you'll have to forgive us, listeners, because we're still learning. We're still people.
Oh, yeah. And here's a hot take. Black Panther is not a diverse movie.
Oof.
I'm sorry. Please, before you cancel me, at least allow me to eke out a few words. Diversity, by its own definition, is an amalgamation of several different elements. Black Panther is not a diverse movie. It is a movie made by mostly black people, starring mostly blacks. It is not a diverse movie. Now, I understand that in America, at least, our understanding of diversity is, Daniel, you need to think about it proportionally. Black people are the minority of America, so this feature is mostly minorities, so it is diverse. If that is your definition, then I will say, sure, yes, it is a diverse movie. But when you look at the standard definition of diversity, this is not a diverse movie. It does not celebrate the variety of human culture. It celebrates one particular aspect. That doesn't make it bad. I don't think the movie was that good, but that doesn't make it bad. I think what makes it bad is when we use diversity as the sole barometer of quality.
Yeah.
That is not true. This movie features a lot of black people as the cast. In fact, in some ways, it was innovative, because even back in the day when this movie came out, Hollywood execs were wary about it because they didn't think that a movie featuring a black lead would sell well in the South. And yet, they were utterly shocked when this movie performed excellently in the South.
And also, Sidney Poitier is like one of the best actors of his time. Like, oh, he was my favorite.
He's great.
The intensity that he brings to every scene, I just can't get over it.
Yes, yes. Sidney Poitier is absolutely talented. And there's a lot of talented people here. So bringing this back around, a lot of modern movies are like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, except a lot less craft put into it. I feel like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner falls into the same pitfalls, but it does so with more effort put into it. So I have more forgiveness for it. What a lot of modern movies tend to do these days is, as we mentioned in our casually is our casual correspondence review. Watch that if you haven't. Listen to it. You can't watch it. Listen to it.
Stare at the screen while it plays on your phone or tablet or computer.
We're blurring the line between art and propaganda, and we're becoming more propagandic. If you don't like Black Panther, you're racist. If you don't like Captain Marvel, you're a misogynist. No.
Well, I hope neither of those are true.
Yeah.
Because I'm in trouble if that is true.
We celebrate Knives Out. Who's the main character of Knives Out? A woman who is a Hispanic woman. And I...
What does that mean?
No one was complaining. No one said, if you hate Knives Out, then you're a misogynist racist. No. No. Elizabeth Banks, in her movie, the reboot of Charlie's Angels, she hyper-feminized it, and she said, before it came out, she said, if you don't like this movie, then you're clearly a misogynist. Guess what? Men and women bonded together, regardless of their sex, to say, Elizabeth Banks, your movie sucks.
Ooh.
So yes, I think in a way Elizabeth Banks did do what she wanted to do, but in the exact opposite way that she expected for it to.
I wanna make a distinguishment here. I'm not saying left or right is right or wrong. I'm saying
Sure. It's
a cultural thing. We are an individualistic culture, and as a result, we need to be celebrated individually based on the features that define us. In a collectivist culture, which has its fair share of flaws, These distinguishments are not acknowledged, not celebrated, because the collective is more important. And I feel like the pendulum has been swinging back and forth, and I think maybe during this time, in the late 60s, early 70s, we were trying to swing back, in this movie, if it's indicative of anything, we're trying to swing back to a collectivist culture of, hey, we're all the same deep down at the core of things. Can we just celebrate that and enjoy that? But then we swing back, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, and we're back to being individualists, where every single individual is king of their destiny, king of the world, can do anything they want. And that comes with its own problems as well. So I do think in a individualist culture that we are swimming in right now, this film would drown.
Yes. Yes, I think it would.
What was your favorite scene in this movie, Daniel?
Oh, it's so hard to distinguish because they all take place mostly in a few locations. I think whenever Sidney Poitier is talking with, at the very beginning, the ladies are talking, they're kind of bonding. The mother is at first really shocked, but she warms up really quickly and kind of gets over whatever she might be having on the inside pretty quick. But Sidney Poitier, John Prentice, is talking with Matt Drayton, Spencer Tracy's character. And they're having a really good conversation. It's clear that Matt Drayton really respects John Prentice in a number of ways. I feel that at the beginning, that was really, really well done. I do like whenever characters go one-on-one, it really means a lot. Monsignor Ryan, now that you've portrayed him, at least in your eyes, as possibly the writer imparting their own voice, I can't unsee that.
I'm so sorry.
It's kind of ruined the character a bit.
I love that character.
No, that means you're right.
I love him.
That means I feel you're right. But I do like, I like the levity, but I also like the bluntness he brings to it.
Yeah.
I'd like to think in a more optimistic way, I think of him as a catalytic figure. If he wasn't there, I feel like a lot of people would be kind of stuck in their ways. But then again, he doesn't really change a whole lot.
I disagree. He absolutely like nails.
Restore my optimism, James.
He nails
Restore
it on the head in like the middle, somewhere dead in the middle of the second act. He's talking with the two parents, and he says they have considered the risks, and if their love is strong enough to still draw them together, it will keep them together. And then, Katharine Hepburn's character, Christina Drayton, walks away and says, just keep saying beautiful things to him while I go, you know, get ready. and right there, I was like, well, that's the end of the movie. That, like, that's all you need to say, you know? Like, they wouldn't be together unless they had weighed things out. Speaking of weighing things out, one last thing I'll touch on. Character I had the biggest problem with was Joey, actually. She never really seemed to get hers. Her impulsivity never really got called out. She's such a spoiled twerp, and like you said before, just her dad telling her to close her mouth was not her due penance. I feel like there should have been more of a compromise in in the plan that she completely concocted, there should have been some sort of bending on her end.
Yes. I feel like Spencer, sorry, again, Matt Drayton, for him to, in his dialogue scene, call out John Prentice and Joey Drayton and just say, my issue, if it again, depends on the route. If we were going the route of he was a bit closeted of a racist and had to realize and acknowledge his own prejudices, this would play out differently. But if we're going the route of you guys have not understood where I've come from, and I'm going to call you out on the things that you guys seem to have ignored, I think he could have called out John Prentice and Joey Drayton and said, you guys are basing this all on my biases, but you are not seeing the recklessness at which you're going about your own rest of your lives together. Mm-hmm. He did this a little when he called out John Prentice for the ultimatum that he set before him and his wife by saying, I will refuse to marry your daughter if there are any objections among you. So I liked that a little bit, but I think he could have taken it a step further and called out Joey, his own daughter, and just said, Joey, I love you, but this was not an appropriate way of setting the weight on this.
Yeah.
If you didn't care about my objections, you should marry this man. If you care at all about what I have to say, why would you want me to give you a rushed assessment of this man?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Why do you care about my opinion if this is all you're giving me?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I feel like he has a lot more weight he could have pulled there.
Mm-hmm. And the amount of times that Joey said something and John just sort of like clenched his teeth and like kind of okay, I guess this is what we're doing. She was like, I'll just come with you right now. He's like, all right. You know, there's just a lot of times where she was like steering the ship and John was like, oh man, I don't know about this. Here's, like, I love you, but wow, this is a lot. Yeah.
Here's James. We have a tendency of rewriting some of the endings of movies we've watched. Here's how I would hastily rewrite this kind of from the, 1001-foot perspective. What I would have done is I would have had Joey try and push things further. I don't know how she would have done that, but they're all together. His family's together. Her family's together.
I know how.
And maybe she...
I know how.
She, okay.
Sarah had this theory when we were watching the movie. She said, they're going to get married, aren't they? They've got a priest right there. They're just going to get married in the dining room.
I thought that the beginning. Yeah, okay. That... We need to have your wife on this podcast because there's just so many things you reference her saying that I'm like, oh, why not just bring her on as like a
Sarah
guest?
Newton, my wife will be our special guest now, from now on forever. She's my special guest in my heart. I love you, Sarah.
See, you can't say you love your wife and then me not acknowledge it. That was wholesome. That was wholesome. Sarah, if you're listening to this, you're a lucky girl and James is lucky to have you. Maybe we'll replace him with you someday. Who knows? Whoa. Anyway. Anyway. Threats aside. Okay, so yeah, I love that idea. Joey is just saying, you know what? To heck with all the bothersome trip planning and money thing. Let's just get married right here and now. I feel like that would somehow cause her father to lash out publicly in a way. He would embarrass himself and he would be forced to confront his own prejudices. Then he has a scene where he has to confront the reality that something needs to change in him or with the situation. And he has a quiet time to reflect. His own wife, who he constantly keeps backing away, could maybe harken back to, hey, remember when you first saw me, or blah, 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 blah. And that kind of makes him think. And then he emerges from his room with his wife, and he monologues. Because I still like the monologue. Because in a scene where it's dialogue heavy, in a movie that's dialogue heavy, I still like the idea of a monologue. But let's do this differently. Let's rewrite it a little bit. Joey, having seen her father lash out, has questioned herself at this point, like, what have I done? She could have a private moment with John Prentice where he says, listen, I love you, but sometimes you're a little headstrong. It's kind of like baby's first couples argument, you know? They're working out their dynamic as well, but they're emerging stronger. And Matt Drayton sees that too, and Christina Drayton sees that as well. And in his monologue, that way you could say he apologizes, Matt Drayton apologizes for his... confusion, him trying to sort things out, his possible prejudice, but then also him calling out John and Joey specifically for saying, yes, I'm not a perfect man, and you've seen those sides of me today, and I wish you hadn't. That being said, you did not go about this in a careful, cautious, or thoughtful way. And as you will learn from a long life of marriage, as I have with your mother, Care, caution, and thought are everything when it comes to caring about the person you love, or in this case, want to love. I feel like that, something along those lines, would be a great way to bookend it.
I like that. And he could simultaneously make up with his wife, you know, at that, during that scene. Because you do kind of get a bit of that in the original dialogue that's there, but it's not quite as impactful.
All right, guys. Well, that being said, we're Daniel and James, and you've been listening to our podcast, Casually Critical. Tune in next week where we pitch our new episode for our hit comedy series called Guess Who's Coming to Breakfast.